This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, sitting in for Terry Gross. Eric Idle is best known as a member of Monty Python's Flying Circus, the British comedy troupe whose bold, lunatic, irreverent, and very intelligent style influenced just about everyone and everything in the world of comedy, from Second City and Saturday Night Live to South Park. The Python impact is still going strong. A new musical called Spamalot, a stage version of Monty Python and the Holy Grail, is in previews on Broadway right now after a sold-out run in Chicago. It's directed by Mike Nichols and stars David Hyde Pierce, Tim Curry, and Hank Azaria. Idle wrote the book for the musical. He's also written a new hardcover book, Greedy Bastard Diary, published this month. In the late 70s, Idle was brilliant as a loving send-up of Paul McCartney in one of the best documentary satires ever made, The Ruddles, All You Need Is Cash. A sequel to that telemovie, The Ruddles 2, Can't Buy Me Cash, will be released next month as a DVD original. Here's a clip from the 1975 film Monty Python and the Holy Grail, in which Eric and his fellow pythons are trying to decipher the meaning of a message carved in the wall of a cave.
There! Look! What does it say? What language is that? Brother Maynard, you're our scholar. It's Aramaic. Of course, Joseph of Arimathea.
Of course.
What does it say?
It reads, here may be found the last words of Joseph of Arimathea. He who is valiant and pure of spirit may find the Holy Grail in the castle of...
What?
The castle of...
What is dead?
He must have died while carving it.
Oh, come on.
Well, that's what it says.
Look, if he was dying, he wouldn't bother to carve Arg. He'd just say it.
Well, that's what's carved in the rock. Perhaps he was dictating.
Oh, shut up. Well, does it say anything else?
No. Just
When Terry spoke with Eric Idle in 1999, he brought along his guitar, and she asked him to perform and explain the famous closing song from Monty Python and the Life of Brian. As the movie envisions it, Brian was a lesser-known contemporary of Jesus Christ's, who also ends up on a crucifix along with several other unfortunate prisoners. Brian tries to cheer them up by leading them in song, a song called Always Look on the Bright Side of Life. Eric Idle told Terry what they had in mind when they came up with the song.
Well, we had to face a complex problem of how to deal with all our characters who were heading towards crucifixion, and there was no way of getting out of it. It was a common form of death for the Romans. It was like public hanging, you know. So we knew they were all going to have to die, and we couldn't face how could we deal with this image of the crucifixion. And we knew we were going to have a lot of people crucified because the Romans were fond of mass crucifixions. And so I said, well, let's do a song, you know, and it should be a cheery song. And so we thought the idea of people sort of singing a rather bright song as they being crucified, because they've got a couple of days, was a kind of wonderfully British sort of way of looking at things. And so I went off and I just came back and wrote this little quick little ditty, which has become an anthem in England for the many times we lose at sport.
And, of course, in the movie, your character's getting crucified as well, and you kind of kick off the song, and then all the guys getting crucified join in.
Yes. It's a rousing experience.
Would you sing it for us?
Sure. Some things in life are bad. They can really make you mad. Other things just make you swear and curse. When you're chewing on life's gristle, don't grumble, give a whistle, and this'll help things turn out for the best. And always look on the bright side of life. Always look on the light side of life. If life seems jolly rotten, there's something you've forgotten. And that's to laugh and smile and dance and sing. When you're feeling in the dumps, be silly chumps, just purse your lips and whistle, that's the thing. And always look on the bright side of life. Always look on the light side of life. 'Cause life is quite absurd, and
yes, the final word. You must always face the curtain with a bow. Forget about your sin, give the audience a grin. Enjoy it, it's your last chance anyhow. And always look on the bright side of death. Just before you draw your terminal breath. For life's a bitch as if, when you look at it, life's a laugh and death's a joke, it's true. You'll see it's all a show, keep on laughing as you go. Just remember that the last laugh is on you. And always look on the bright side of life. Come on. Always look on the bright side of life. Always look on the bright side of life. Always look on that bright side of life.
That's a great song, and I love the way you do it. I love the whistling that little and that little trombone sound that you get at the end there. That's new, isn't it?
Well, I've always been able to do that. It's kind of a boarding school thing. When you're stuck at boarding school for 12 years, one of the things you learn to do are silly and pointless things that help to pass the time. So I can do... You know, I can do horn, French horn, and various things. I've used them on records, too. It's cheaper than musicians.
I think, you know, your most famous Python sketch is the Nudge Nudge Wink Wink sketch. Two men meeting for the first time in a bar. Did you write this sketch?
Yes, I did write the sketch.
Tell us about how you wrote it.
I wrote it for another show. I wrote it for Ronnie Barker, who was one of the two Ronnies. And I sent it in to some Frost show. And they sent it back, unused, because, of course, if you look at the script, it's incredibly boring. There are no jokes in it. It says, is your wife a goer? Know what I mean, know what I mean. Say no more, say no more. Nudge, nudge, know what I mean. Say no more, nudge, 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 nudge. It just comes straight back. And then I thought, well, that was rather funny. So I read it out at one of the really early Python meetings. Say, is your wife a goer? Eh? Know what I mean? Say no more, know what I mean. Nudge, nudge, eh? Wink, wink, eh? Is she a goer? Eh? Does she go? Eh? And, of course, they fell about, because it's kind of in the performance. And it's sometimes it's very hard to read comedy scripts. That's why Hollywood is so notoriously bad at reading comedy scripts, because it's often in just as the way you do it. I mean, I once picked up a Cleese sketch, a headmaster sketch, and I thought, there's nothing funny about this. And then I saw him do it, and he just reduced me to tears.
What kind of guy inspired this sketch?
The Nudge Boy is very much an English wide boy. He's, you know, he's down a pub. He's always down a pub, and he's, you know, he's a bit of a Jack the Lad. He rather fancies himself. But, of course, it's rather sad at the end, you know. He says, you know, you've slept with a lady. Yes. What's it like? So he's sort of kind of, he's that irritatingly nudgy person that really people don't behave like if they are well-behaved.
Well, let me play the Python sketch.
Your wife interested in photography, eh? Photographs, eh? He asked him knowingly.
Photography?
Yeah. Snap, snap, grin, grin, wink, wink, nudge, nudge, say no more.
Oh, holiday stamps.
Could be. Could be taken on holiday, could be. Swimming costumes. Nudge, nudge. Candid. Candid photography.
No, I'm afraid we don't have a camera.
Oh. Still. Oh! Eh? Eh? Oh!
Look, are you trying to insinuate something?
No, 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 no. Yes.
Well?
Well, I mean, you're a man of the world, aren't you? I mean, you know, you've been around, you've been there.
What do you mean?
Well, I mean, like, you've done it, with a lady. You've slept with a lady.
Yes.
What's it like?
So after the sketch, Eric Idle, did people come up to you for years and do the whole nudge, nudge, wink, wink thing?
That's still probably the most quoted to me, yes. And people love it so much, I just enjoy doing it. So in my stage show, I'm doing him a bit more.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Now your father died in World War II.
Yeah.
What were the circumstances of his death? He was killed on the way home?
Well, it's just kind of ironic. You know, he was in the RAF from 1941, and he was a rear gunner in a bomber, in bombers and things, and that's a very dangerous role. And then they were coming home on leave, and they said, well, don't use the railways, they'll be crowded, it's coming towards Christmas time. You guys should hitchhike, because everybody gave the forces rides when they're in uniform. So he got a ride, and he was in the back of a lorry, a truck, and a car swerved and cut in front of them, and they went off the road, and he was crushed, and he sort of died on Christmas Eve. So it was kind of bitterly ironic, you know.
And I don't know how to say this exactly, but it kind of feeds the sense of tragic absurdity.
It certainly gives you a sense of irony. Of course, I was two and a bit, so I didn't really know why Christmases were so miserable and depressing. It really affected my mother. She never actually recovered from it. And she went into a bleak depression. And part of my theory in the book is, and it's not just my theory, people I went into research a bit, is that comedians are formed by maternal abandonment and that they seek to replace some kind of parental love that they're not getting by being cute and funny and doing anything to entertain and solicit this love and this laughter from strangers.
And so that's your theory about why you became a comedian?
It probably accounts for why I did. I noticed on the playground with my daughter, who's nine, that when I go in there, I can tell which kids don't have mothers at home because they're being funny.
So you were sent to a boarding school that you've described as a semi-orphanage. In what way was it like an orphanage?
Well, it was an orphanage until the week before I got there, and it changed its name. It was it was the Royal Orphanage, and it became the Royal School. And what happened was I was sent there, and the RAF paid for my education, and they just took over this orphanage, and they sent all the kids who had lost fathers. So I grew up in, it's a very bizarre thing to do, I grew up with a whole group of kids who were stuck into this sort of horrible Victorian orphanage at seven. With none of them had a father, or most of them didn't have a father. So we had no sense of what fathers are or were.
Did you do plays and music and showbiz kind of things in boarding school?
No, absolutely. I used to have puppets, and we do puppet theatres and write and perform, and we were voices off. It's very much like what I do when performing. I'm very much more comfortable in makeup and with wigs and moustaches and beards. It took me a long time to become an actor who can just be just me or closer to my physical looks without some kind of disguise.
Mm-hmm. Now, I know when I was in public school in the States in grade school, one of the songs that we had to sing when we were in assembly was All Things Bright and Beautiful. And you wrote a very funny parody of that song. And I'm wondering if you had to sing All Things Bright and Beautiful when you were in boarding school?
Absolutely, and it always struck me as being wonderfully ironic. You know, it's like, well, what about all the other stuff in that was created? Was that not created by God too?
Can you sing us a little bit of All Things Dull and Ugly, your parody of All Things Bright and Beautiful?
I shall try. All things dull and ugly, all creatures short and squat. All things rude and nasty, the Lord God made the lot. Each nasty little hornet, each beastly little squid. Who made the spiny urchin? Who made the sharks? He did. All things dull and cancerous, all pox both great and small. Putrid, foul, and gangrenous, the Lord God made them all. Amen.
That's very funny. Did you write that while you were in boarding school, or did you have to get much older and more sophisticated before writing that?
No, I was older and should have known better.
Eric Idle speaking to Terry Gross. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. And now for something completely similar. More of Terry's 1999 interview with Monty Python founder Eric Idle.
Now, what was the comedy that influenced you during your formative years?
As I grew up, radio was comedy king in England. We'd hear a lot of comedy on the radio. The Goon Show was very big. And then when television finally appeared, because I grew up without television until I was about 12, I loved Dick Van Dyke and I loved Bill Coe very much. And we got a lot of American comedy. But the thing that really changed my life was in 1962, I went to see a show in London called Beyond the Fringe, which had Peter Cook, Dudley Moore, Jonathan Miller, and Alan Bennett. And it was the funniest single review I have ever seen. And I just rolled around, and it changed my life. I learned all the words, and it suddenly made clear to me that all the authority I'd been suffering under was absolutely a load of nonsense. And my instincts to be subversive were absolutely right. And that these people were funny, and they were imposing their views of life on you. The military, the church, the teachers, all of this was actually mockable.
Did you ever play in a rock band or a folk band when you were a teenager?
I grew up playing the guitar. It was one of the great things was Elvis sort of gave us all great heart and hope and the Everly Brothers. And so when I was 14, Elvis came into my life. And then I had to have a guitar. And we would play folk music. We'd play a lot of, Negro spirituals and things. And we identified very much with the black slaves of the south part of America. And we'd sing all these,
Let my people
songs
go.
About Jim Crow. Exactly. We were totally identified with that. It was very interesting. And then, I played a bit of harmonica and guitar. And then eventually, when the Beatles came through, everybody tried to play pop music. And that's when I got into that.
Let me ask you, if you would, to play a few bars of a song from the old days, a song you used to do as a teenager.
What do you do? If you're white, you're all right. And if you're brown, stick around. But if you're black, oh brother, get back, get back, get back.
Good. So were you doing that at, like, folk clubs and things?
Well, at school. No, we didn't go out to folk clubs.
That's right, right. Like,
Sonny Terry and Brownie McGee were huge. I love them. They're so great.
Uh-huh.
Big Brunsy, all those sort of folky things.
Interesting. Yeah. Well, you went to school in Cambridge, got into the performing group Footlights, mm-hmm. where you met some of the other Pythons. You became the president of Footlights, and I read that the first thing you did was to initiate a bill allowing women to join this theater club. What inspired you to open it up to women?
Well, I mean, it was fairly absurd. This club had been going since 1883, and they didn't allow women, into the club. It was absurd. So being a kind of radical kind of 60s thing, I said, no, we absolutely have to admit women. We want to have funny women. We need them for the show as well as anything else. And so a lot of gay dons wept and beseeched me not to change anything. They love these. They're all called Binky and love little men dressed up as ladies and pretty boys singing frightfully witty lyrics. And I said, no, it's absolutely not. This is the 20th century. We have to. And the first woman to join who came through the door, which you could believe it or not, was Germaine Greer.
Oh, no. That's funny.
And she was...
I wouldn't think of her as excelling in comedy, but...
She was tremendous fun. I loved Germaine.
Now, the funny thing is that you opened up the doors of Footlights to women, but, of course, the Pythons had no women in the group. Why didn't you want women in the group?
Well, it's not a question of why didn't we want them. There wasn't a woman that we knew who was from the background that we were drawing our pool of chaps from. I mean, it's a conflation of two shows, Python. There was a kid's show called Do Not Adjust Your Set, and there was a show called Not the 1948 Show. At last, it's the 1948 Show. And, if there had been a great writer, performer, woman, she could easily have been in it. But there wasn't. She wasn't around. This person wasn't there. And it was certainly easier. It was just easier for us. And that's the way it was. I mean, why were there no women in the Beatles? It's one of those questions,
On asking Paul McCartney that sometime soon. So of course, this left the Pythons to play the women's parts themselves. What kind of woman do you think of yourself as having specialized in?
Well, I used to play one version or other of my aunts, where there were four aunts, and they were all in various qualities of class structure. And I used to play very much the upper-middle-class aunt, type of aunt, because I like those. And also, You don't have to alter your voice terribly much to be in their sort of register and timbre, you know? And I like that sort of a very English, rather correct lady who's very, very well-mannered and polite, but rather firm.
Eric Idle, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Would you close with a song for us?
I'd like to close with a song which is my favourite song, my wife's favourite song, and it's a song that Clint Black has just recorded on his new album, and I wrote him a new intro for it, and it's called The Galaxy Song. Whenever life gets you down and things seem sad and bad, just remember that you're travelling on a planet that's evolving and revolving at 900 miles an hour. That's orbiting at 19 miles a second, so it's reckoned the sun that is the source of all our power. The sun and you and me and all the stars that we can see are moving at a million miles a day. In an outer spiral arm at 40,000 miles an hour of the galaxy we call the Milky Way. Our galaxy itself contains 100 million stars. It's 100,000 light years side to side. It bulges in the middle, 16,000 light years thick, but out by us it's just 3,000 light years wide. We're 40,000 light years from galactic central point. We go round every 200 million years. And our galaxy is only one of millions and billions in this amazing and expanding universe. The universe itself keeps on expanding and expanding in all of the directions it can whiz. As fast as it can go, at the speed of light, you know, 12 million miles a minute, and that's the fastest speed there is. So remember when you're feeling very small and insecure, how amazingly unlikely is your birth. And pray that there's intelligent life somewhere out in space, 'cause there's bugger all down here on Earth.
Eric Idle speaking and singing with Terry Gross in 1999. He's written the book for the new musical Spamalot, now in previews on Broadway. It stars David Hyde Pierce and Tim Curry and is based on the movie Monty Python and the Holy Grail. Coming up, David Edelstein on the new Japanese film Nobody Knows. This is Fresh Air.